So I've been thinking quite a lot about writing, ostensibly because I've been discussing that with a few PhD students today, but also because I'm ready to write this next monograph, The Hopeless University. And I was thinking this morning about the kind of the weight and the pressure of it all and of deadlines. And in particular, I was reminded of my old PhD supervisor, Bill Speck, who wrote about British politics in the late 17th, 18th century, and then moved on to studying Robert Southey, the poet, 18th century man of letters, when he retired, and kind of thinking about Bill's back catalogue and thinking about the fact that he was writing and working and reading and researching and producing, working with undergraduates, working with postgraduates, kind of through the late 60s. Into the kind of the noughties, and he was producing stuff. It was quite nice. I was thinking about it in terms of my kind of favorite bands, really, and they're taking time to kind of produce something that was systematic and detailed and concrete and conceptual, and that had some kind of weight to it, some kind of cognitive weight to it. And doing that every kind of 3 or 4 years, so Bill produces something. His PhD supervisor, who incidentally wrote the best kind of book on history that I've ever read, British Politics in the Age of Anne. If you want to get that one by Geoffrey Holmes, anyway, he co-authors a thing with Holmes in 1967. He produces something based on his PhD in 1970. He writes about stability and strife in early Hanoverian England in 1977. Goes on to write about the revolution of 1688, and he's producing stuff every, I don't know, every few years, every 3 years, every 7 or 8 years in terms of kind of monographs. And obviously he's writing journal articles and book chapters in between. But I was thinking about it in terms of kind of conversations I'd had with him about kind of the way in which the sector has shifted, the way in which kind of practice as an academic has moved over time. And certainly ways in which I see it having been amplified after the crash of 2008 and the amplification of the kind of business credentials, the financialization, the marketization, the commodification of academic work that followed. And certainly that kind of that pressure that I feel myself or I put myself under at the moment to get my next book in draft form and get it off to the editors at Mayfly Books. But also I have two journal articles that I need to get done or that I've promised, and there are three book chapters, and they've all got to be done concurrently, and I kind of want to focus on the monograph, and I've just finished doing all of the notes and more of that in a minute, but I've just finished doing all and sorting all of the notes for that, and yet I feel under the weight, the pressure to do these other pieces of work as well, and in particular because other people want those other pieces of work or are expecting those other pieces of work. Not that I need to get them done for the forthcoming research excellence framework, because all of that stuff is done and dusted, and I'm just so disinterested in that kind of quantification of our work anyway. But other people have got these calls, and I want to contribute to them. So that is a completely different kind of set of pressures in terms of getting yourself out there, and I wonder, therefore, the damage that it does to the kind of work that I am trying to produce and the kind of things that I'm trying to write, because I can't write every 3 years or every 2 years or do something substantive and then disappear into the archives to come back and do more substantive stuff in 2 or 3 years' time, because the political economics of the sector and the emotional economy and the immoral economy of the sector does not enable us to behave in that way. And therefore, I worry about the quality, not the quantity, but definitely the quality of the argumentation and the novelty of the argumentation and the relationships in the argumentation that I'm producing. I've been thinking about that as well because the next book on The Hopeless University, or it's what have I've titled it The Hopeless University : Intellectual Work at the End of the End of History. So I'm picking up on this kind of trope that Auf Hebunga Bunga, the podcast, the global politics podcast at the end of history, have talked about, that we were told that history was off the agenda, that there was no alternative to kind of capitalism as a totalizing system. But all of a sudden, these cracks, these fissures in this global system have become clear to us on a kind of global scale. So certainly in the last few months, global struggles, resistances, protests in Latin and South America, across Africa, swathes of Africa and into the Middle East and Asia. We see a whole range of kind of ruptures that kind of demonstrate that actually agency, people acting individually, socially, communally, people struggling for different kind of ways of reproducing the world are back on the agenda. And I'm kind of considering, well, what is the role of my work and what is the role of the university in that process of reproducing a system that is going into meltdown and failing, that is struggling to reproduce itself and that is becoming more authoritarian in the process, that is disabling us from dealing with issues around, say, climate warming, for instance, that maintains separations and competition between individuals and subject areas within institutions and institutions themselves, that is kind of potentially we see contributing to nationalist and patriotic agendas just as much as it is to kind of what we think is global agendas. So I've been thinking about those sorts of issues. Been trying to think as well about how this next book is perhaps less discourse heavy, more readable, say if I take my dad as an example. So the last book on the alienated academic, which took the academic, the individual academic and the individual student, but also pointed to professional services staff as its unit of analysis, it was very theory heavy. And I remember my friend Michael asking me who was I writing it for, and in part I said to him that I'm writing it for me, really, in order to prove that I can get something that is in this domain, in this Marxist and education domain, because as I mentioned a few minutes ago, by trade I was a historian. I was always a jack of all trades, right? But by trade, I guess I was a historian, and then I'm moving into education, and I'm moving into kind of Marxist critiques and forms of kind of humanist Marxist critiques. And it's a kind of, you've got to attempt to sort of own the space a little bit. So for me, I was writing, or I replied to Michael, I was writing for me because I needed to be able to write 70,000 words that I felt did justice to a particular set of traditions. And they are quite theory heavy. And I'm a kind of theoretical guy, really. I like the conceptual, and I like trying to make sense of the world through concepts, the concrete world through concepts. But I want this next thing, I think, to be, it'll be as conceptual, but hopefully written in a more accessible way. And I've been trying to think about that in the context of my writing as well, and whether I can kind of open myself out to that. I've been trying to think very much about, I suppose, the relationship between the concrete university, the everyday university, the university that we experience in our teaching and our research, in our interactions in the staff common room, in our research seminars, in our marking of our students' work, in those concrete everyday experiences that kind of make the institution. I'm trying to think about that in a broader context of what is going on in that kind of feeding frenzy around institutions of policy wonks, of consultancies, of technology suppliers, of government or elected kind of or unelected policy advisors, this whole feeding frenzy, this infrastructure, what Stephen Ball describes in Global Education Incorporated as a kind of almost a geography of neoliberalism that is enacted through transnational activist networks. You get networks effectively that operate as joint ventures that predate on state-based or on public assets like education, for instance. So I'm very interested in kind of how the concrete reality of policy, how that's enacted through acts of parliament, through secondary legislation, through ways in which services get resold into institutions to support learning advisors or to support disability support or whatever it might be. I'm interested in those concrete realities that operate nationally, transnationally, and in the institution, and then how we conceptualize those. And in part because I guess I'm kind of seeing the university really as a space through which we might describe the kind of the primacy of the economy over our everyday lives, in the development of kind of human capital, in the enforced kind of discourse and narrative around productivity, employability, and enterprise impact, all of those things. So the primacy of the economy, how we describe that primacy over our everyday lives, such that kind of any any desire we have to be more humane, to try to work on issues to do with, say, climate warming or austerity or poverty, they get kind of separated out and they get drawn into kind of competition with each other. So it's this institution versus that institution, or this academic versus that academic. In terms of separation of kind of conceptions and subject areas and individual kind of public engagement and impact and all of that kind of thing. And the idea that actually across a social terrain, I'm unsure that this really helps us deal with anything. So I'm interested in that kind of the relationship between the institution, the concrete institution, and the almost the kind of the totality of the capitalist structure inside which we exist. And if we're thinking about the end of history, so history being back on the agenda, if we're thinking about individual and collective agency and the ability to describe another world or whether another world is possible, I'm interested then in how do we conceptualize the role of the university in that? And part of this really is to sort of to look at what the university reveals, not what it determines, or not what determines it, because increasingly I've been trying to engage with dialectical materialism and certainly Marx's engagement with Hegelian dialectics, and that relationship between the concrete experiences we have, the abstract, the way in which we kind of abstract those and make sense of those and model those, the way in which we might see the university, for instance, almost as a kind of a totality of interactions between, as a process, as an ongoing process. So it moves. So the way in which the university looks in 2008, immediately prior to the crash, when we're thinking about quality enhancement and we're thinking about the student experience in a different way, we're thinking about funding innovation projects in a different way. And what happens immediately after the crash, and then subsequently, when we're focused much more on quality assurance, on value for money, on productivity, on the value of a university degree, on the positional value of that degree, they're very different. It's a process of movement that describes the technologies, the organizational development, the cultures inside institutions, the governance of institutions and their funding, their relationship to society, also their relationship to nature, because we're flying everywhere. We have internationalization projects, we have placements, we have all of that. So I'm interested in those relationships and what they reveal as a kind of a process, really. And to say that those kind of interrelationships between cultures and technologies and modes of delivery and disciplines and all that jazz, they're not independent of each other. And so there's a history and a social context here for the institution that we need to think about in terms of it being a flow between those characteristics, those elements, those ways of working, those disciplines, and that those help us describe how the world at large is organized. So how is education organized? How is higher education organized to reproduce a particular mode of production and a particular mode of existence, which is capitalism, which is framed around driving surplus value. It's framed around driving surpluses in terms of time, in terms of money. And we see that certainly in terms of the institution. And then how does that reveal issues around power and privilege? Who has power and privilege in that space? How do we think about alternative narratives? How do we think about those who've been marginalized? And here I'm thinking about people who have done work on indigenous education or decolonizing, or in black studies, for instance, or feminist critiques of the institution. So I'm interested in kind of whether in addressing those and in thinking about those other concrete experiences of the university, there might be possibilities to describe another world, that we might be able to overturn the world that we have been complicit and not complicit in creating. And part of that then really is to kind of think about how we might then try to, if we can't simply think about renewing the university. Just building a cooperative university is not enough. There has to be social solidarity, social demands. We have to think about whether we machine break and we slow the institution, or whether we accelerate the institution. We need to think about the fact that the context for this is the production of a society that is not based on solidarity, certainly not in the economy. It's based on individualism, the family as an investing capital in education, that we're investing in the human capital of members of families, that potentially their solidarity is ephemeral. And the same with academics. So we see that the turnout for strike action, for instance, is not high enough in a number of institutions for us to get strike action or action short of a strike in the current pay equality casualization pension dispute for UCU. And in those institutions where we've gone through the threshold of 50%, we're looking at 54, 55, 56% in a lot of cases. So solidarity seems more ephemeral. So one of the issues there really is how do we spill over a resistance to a commodified business oriented university that does not enable us, that is hopeless in the context of addressing global crises or emergencies. How do we connect those to broader processes of radicalization and broader processes of renewal and struggle at the level of society, for instance, over healthcare or over welfare or over immigration or over refugee rights, or in fighting for equality in terms of the way in which Black, Asian, minority ethnic people are treated, or the disabled are treated, or whatever it might be. So, I'm trying to think about that in the context of this new book, and I've put online, and I'll put in the notes just a link to the structures for each of the seven chapters that I'm proposing, and the headline statements for each of those really are hopefully quite simple. The first chapter, which is an attempt to define a terrain of hopelessness inside which institutions in the global north function, by a focus really upon that kind of pivotal moment of 2007-8 and the financial crash, and what that means for that kind of terrain, the way in which universities and institutions, because the institution is the kind of unit of analysis for this book, the ways in which they are or they have been subsumed, re-engineered for the generation of surpluses in the global north, and that filters through into the global south. So I want to really think about the crisis of higher education in terms of its governance, its regulation, its funding, in terms of issues around a focus on value. And it's interesting that there's some discussion online at the moment around the value of education. And one of the big tropes for me over recent years has been the disconnect, the amount of cognitive dissonance that needs to be brought into play for all educators and all sectors about that difference between economic value and humane values, that we are forced to consider economic value in all that we do. And yet when we get in front of young people or mature students or master students or whoever they are in the classroom, this is about them as human beings. It's about humane values and relations and relationships in that space. And that's what gets us out of bed. I'm interested then in the ways, I guess, that there are geographies, what I've kind of labeling geographies of control that get put in place across sectors, across institutions and disciplines within sectors that are framed through anxiety as a motive force, that institutions and sectors operate in terms of performance anxiety, in terms of status anxiety, anxiety around privilege, the maintenance of position, whether you can put food on the table, whether you are precariously employed, all of those things. So part of this is around that there are geographies of control that then reproduce senses of hopelessness. And in this, I've been doing quite a lot of reading around learned helplessness, but also hopeless depression, because the way in which I'm treating hopelessness is almost in a kind of dual way. The first is that institutions have no hope. They contain no hope. They contain no hope for dealing with global crises because they are framed in anti-human, a-human, unhuman, non-human ways. Generally, they are framed through metrics, and they are framed through commodification, and they are framed through competition, and they are framed through the division of labor. They are framed through money and the market. So that's the first trope. The second, which picks up really on some work I did in The Alienated Academic around Weltschmerz and this kind of sense of kind of ennui, a kind of a sort of a position that is beyond depression, that is a hopeless position that kind of sees the university as useless almost, and therefore sees one's own engagement and work in the space as useless for dealing with a range of issues. So it lacks hope, and it's also useless in that kind of same context. So I'm interested then in, I guess, in whether it is possible to describe that in more detail and then to move beyond it. So in that kind of second chapter, which is about hopeless struggle in what I call the anxiety machine, and I've blogged about the university, the idea of the university as an anxiety machine, and that is a kind of deeply autobiographical thing for me. I've blogged about that a number of times, and then I wrote a piece with Kate Bowles about what it was to be ill in the university, thinking about that in terms of the way in which the university has been re-engineered or subsumed, really subsumed in Marxist terms, thinking about kind of Marx's work in Capital, about the way in which capital colonizes institutions in order to kind of drive the generation of surplus and then re-engineers them in order to kind of build a kind of competitive infrastructure on top of that. So we get a re-engineering of institutions, and that makes us anxious because we're placed into competition with each other for status, for resources. So I'm thinking about hopeless struggle, thinking about the way in which the university builds these immoral economies. I'm very much kind of taken with E.P. Thompson's work on the moral economy of the English crowd and the way in which kind of in the 18th century labourers would make moral judgments about the action of particular businessmen or particular local worthies in their allocation of resources or their setting of a policy or bylaws or whatever they might be. And I'm trying to think about this really in terms of kind of an immoral economy of the university in terms of what it demands of individuals, in terms of policy and practice and what that demands of individuals. And then to try and frame that though around kind of the political economy of the university as a political economy of hopelessness, because our work is all of a sudden being revealed to us as the ongoing everyday sale of our labour power. So we have to keep returning into an academic market when actually we think we're here to be educating students about to become teachers or to become accountants or to become whatever it is, or just to become better people, more educated people, whatever that might be. But actually, this is the ongoing alienation of ourselves that it requires. So we have to keep coming and selling our labour power, and we have no control over workload, or we have no control over the labour process. We have no control over the things that we write and the things that we make because someone else owns the copyright. And so we see ourselves as individuals becoming commodified. We are historians, or we are vets, or we are nurses, or whatever it might be. And it hives off parts of ourselves. It privileges certain parts of ourselves. So my role as a professor gets privileged, and it begins to bleed and infect other bits of my life, so that I'm working at weekends and I'm working on evenings and I'm marking student work when I shouldn't be, or I'm checking stuff when I'm on leave. So I go away at the weekend to watch St Johnstone versus Kilmarnock with a very dear friend, but I end up doing work on the train up and down for the book, as it happens. I'm then very interested. One of the big things that came through in The Alienated Academic for me and my work on decolonizing at De Montfort, but also in this book, is to try to decenter my white male professorial privilege. So I'm very interested here in intersectional hopelessness. So what do we do about that? How are we engaging with a variety of voices? Ostensibly because my position is that the voices that we listen to get us into this mess are not the ones that I want to listen to get us out. We then move on, or I then move on. I know it's we thing is because it's just like me, right? And I then move on to kind of three chapters on really that kind of go into the kind of concrete, or attempt to go into the concrete of the institution. And the first is on forms of hopelessness. So this is like structures, institutional structures of hopelessness. The second is what I'm calling pathological hopelessness, so the diseased nature of the university's cultures. The third is methodological hopelessness. This is the practices of the institution, and there's a lot more that's dialectical in that, because I'm going to write a journal article on the dialectical Hegelian university. So in this third chapter on forms of hopelessness, thinking about this in terms of the university as a joint venture, that they are brought to you in association with policymakers and policy wonks, with consultants, with businesses that have bought in for accelerated degrees or accelerated courses, it's brought to us in association with technologies and publishers and all of that. And that there's a feeding frenzy around institutions. And so there's a thing about them being hopeless ventures. And I also then I'm very interested in how that idea of hopelessness becomes a flow. So thinking about it in I guess kind of Deleuzean terms, thinking about institutions as assemblages through which there are flows of negativity, and within that then we can be I can begin to look at kind of the concrete reality of hopelessness. I'm interested in institutions as associations of capitals, and Marx writes about this, joint ventures, and also he points to the kind of the possibility that those joint ventures could be inverted, that this is capital in a cooperative form, that all of these associations have to work cooperatively together to extract surplus. So does that give us an infrastructure to do something different? In the current kind of institutionalization, I suppose we see these things as kind of more difficult because of finance capital, and the demands of finance capital. So I'm going to write about that, and then I'm writing about the ways in which this defines in the current form of the institution of forms of unfreedom, really, because our engagement with ourselves, our engagement with our communities, our engagement with our societies and nature, technologies, are all mediated through the need to drive surplus. And the university acts as a node in that. And we return to the university every day in order to kind of maintain that. So I end then by trying to think about whether we can, thinking, I suppose, around Bloch's work on venturing beyond, whether it is possible to venture beyond hopelessness inside the current institution. It leads me on to the kind of this next chapter on pathological hopelessness, which starts with a focus upon surplus everything. That everything is predicated on driving surplus. Money, time, labor, impact, excellence, whatever it might be. However, also surplus populations. So one of the things here is about the way in which the diseased nature of the institution drives competition, drives anxiety, and that is cascaded throughout what I call the academic peloton. And again, this picks up on something from Kate Bowles' work, this idea that the university, that academic research institutes operate like the peloton in professional cycling, where everything gets calibrated around the highest performing individual. And if that individual is Lance Armstrong and they're doping, the rest of the peloton, in order to maintain discipline but also to compete, has to dope, has to overwork, has to do whatever it is, has to self-harm. And so this is the idea that the peloton is effectively a highly competitive, highly machinic, highly performance-driven entity that is predicated upon self-harm, anxiety. And we see this in terms, for instance, of the number of casualized workers, precarious workers, PhDs that can't find jobs, that whole range of surplus population. So this idea of surplus everything includes the idea that we are surplus. We are at any point potentially surplus to requirement. I want to frame that then around this idea of that certain bodies and certain norms are reified, in particular the norms of white men who with no caring responsibilities, that's the archetype. And so we see people tweeting about having worked 100 hours a week, or that if you aren't in your lab for 80 hours, then you don't count. And if you don't bring in this amount of research funding, you're out on your ear. And I then want to kind of focus a little bit in that on what we call academic ill-being. So we hear quite a lot about well-being and resilience and all that jazz. I'm interested in academic ill-being. Why have there been a spate of suicides? Why are people ill? Why is there an explosion in people going off with occupational health referrals and then being signed off work? What does that mean? What does that mean about this allegedly humane role that we have? And is it possible then to describe a new humanism within the university as it is? I want to describe that in the fifth chapter in terms of methodological hopelessness and the idea that the university, the way in which the university is constructed, the way in which it reproduces itself, is so that it can be socially useful in producing commodities for a market that are financialized and drives value and drives surpluses, money, impact, whatever, but that is socially useful hopelessness because it has no value beyond the market, beyond our ability to pay down our debts, beyond the ability to put food on the table, but it doesn't enable us to deal with big issues around poverty or inclusion or global warming or around the collapse in the nitrogen cycle or whatever it might be. I want to think about that in terms of the dialectical university, about the way in which the university is constructed methodologically, the way in which those kind of different components I spoke about earlier feed into each other and relate to each other, the way in which the concrete experiences of our everyday might then be abstracted and be defined conceptually. I'm interested in what I call technologies of separation, so disciplinary separations, about the ways in which we are individually separated through issues to do with workload, through the management of work online, through expectations of work online, through organizational development techniques, through the expectations of staff for mandatory training, and also thinking about things that impact differentially upon other bodies that are Black, Asian, minority ethnic, things like Prevent, for instance. So I'm interested in thinking about those as ways in which we are separated from each other in order to reproduce surpluses for a system that is increasingly alienating. Within that, I want to focus upon time, how our time is controlled, our agency is denied. I want to focus upon ecological issues here as well, and what this means for the engagement with ecological crises. I'm then kind of on to, I'm hoping that in each of those chapters, there will be a kind of more positive spin. In the previous book, in The Alienated Academic, I kind of had a couple of chapters at the end, which were more hopeful, that kind of look towards what might be done. And this is the thing that everyone wants, right? What is to be done? I'm not interested in recommendations, because part of the outcome of this is definitely to focus upon dialogue, humane dialogue, new forms of engagement, new subjectivities. In the sixth chapter here, Hopeful Despair, I'm interested in whether actually by discussing our stories, our solidarity between our stories of ongoing alienation, of disconnection, of separation, of ill-being, of Weltschmerz, and then by conceptualizing those as a group, by recentering voices that have been made marginal, by thinking about ways in which they enable us to describe alternative conceptions, we might move dialectically to something different, and that might be hopeful. I want to frame that around indignant movements of struggle that have been occurring globally, well, forever, but in particular I'm interested in that sort of post financial crash stuff that's happened across Europe, in the States, in Canada, linking back to protests kind of from 68 and before, that are movements of kind of indignation about the present state of things that might then enable us to describe new forms of intellectual subjectivities and the way in which the university might be opened up, dissolved into the society. Because I'm not really interested in a reified or fetishized academic labor. I'm interested in intellectual work in society and what that might do as a way of kind of reorganizing, reproducing hope. So in the last chapter, beyond the university, it's deliberately beyond the university at the end of the end of history. I'm thinking about whether another university is desirable. It's one of the things that came out of the university superannuation scheme pension strikes in 2018, was this idea that another university is possible for another university. The university is ours. And I want to question that, really. Within capitalist social relations, is another university desirable? Or are there alternative forms, alternative structures, alternative pathologies or cultures, alternative methodologies and ways of organizing the institution that are possible? Because the pivot for this, for me, is our solidarity economies. They are reframing society and intellectual work at the end of history. And one final thing to kind of think about for me in terms of this has been, how do we do this? There's been quite a lot of reading. I've loved listening to the Swampside Chats podcast and From Alpha to Omega about revolutionary strategy and about thinking about transition and communization. Is this transitional? If we're heading towards, if it's like socialism or barbarism, if we're thinking about moving beyond, is this about some form of structure? Is it about is it about using and repurposing, converting the university into a cooperative in order to connect to other cooperatives, in order to build a transitional movement to move beyond? Or is this about radical change at the level of society? And I'm very mindful of the psychological difficulties of that, of communizing straight away. And I'm very mindful of Marx's work in the Critique of the Gotha Programme, that a move towards a lower stage of communism emerges from within capital and the structures and cultures and forms and technologies of capital, and that we then move to a higher stage. And we can't describe that because it's a movement and a process and a dialogue. So I'm interested in this idea of transition versus revolution, and the psychology of it and the emotional well-being of it, and the fact that we have to bring billions of people, they have to take themselves on a journey, and that academics have to see themselves not as some kind of fetishized, reified, outsourced expert who will solve this, but someone who can facilitate a discussion. So that's where I'm looking to go with all of this. I might go now. I've kind of talked for half an hour, and really it was a means of blowing a bit of time before I go to the pub at 5 o'clock, before I go to the theatre tonight, which I'm very much looking forward to seeing, about the Trojan horse scandal around Islamophobia in Birmingham schools from 2014. So I'm very interested in seeing that again, because that is about the concrete experiences and how they relate to ways in which we frame policy, practice, understanding, and how we might move forms and pathologies, cultures, methodologies forward. Right, going to go now. I wish you well. Keep warm. It's Brexit Eve. I'm sure everything's going to be Okay, as long as we love each other. So let's take care.
Some patron with the